Thank you very much for coming to the LSE this evening. Nice weather to bring everybody out. Right, my name is Abby Innes. I teach European political economy at the European Institute with a specialism on Central Europe, and it's the European Institute that's hosting this event this evening. This talk is being recorded, and we hope that there'll be a podcast of it. So if you have friends and colleagues who were on the waiting list, it should be available. A little housekeeping, if you wouldn't mind turning your phones onto silent, but there is a... you may wish to tweet about this event, and there is a hashtag for this event, which I realise I haven't written down, but I think it's hashtag Orban. I think that would not be too surprising if that were true. Right, it gives me really tremendous pleasure this evening to welcome Professor Paul Lenvay. I think it would be hard to find someone more qualified to comment on the current condition of Hungarian politics. Professor Lenvay has researched and reported on the evolution of Central European politics for over 60 years and with a native insight. He's the author of 17 books in a phenomenal number of languages. He's the winner of the most prestigious prizes in journalism that journalism has to offer, and he was awarded an honorary professorship by the President of Austria for his exceptional scholarship. And certainly as a student of Central Europe, I am personally grateful to Paul Lenvay for his capacity to combine serious research with a journalist's capacity to write like a human being. His new book, Orban, Europe's New Strongman, is a forensic account of how Hungary went from being the region's leading light in the revolution alongside Poland, a leading light in the revolution against communism, but has emerged as Europe's most divisive member state. Viktor Orban has redefined Hungary quite explicitly as an illiberal democracy, both in theory and in practice. And so for the next 30 minutes, Professor Lenvay is going to explain what that means, after which we're going to have 40 minutes for questions. Thank you very much, Professor Lenvay.
Well, I first of all thank you for the invitation, and thank you for being here and running this discussion. It is the second time that I speak at LSE. I have two threads of connections to this fantastic institutions. The one through the former director, Sir Lord, not I wanted to say Sir. Then what was he called as Lord? Lord?
Which one? We've had several.
No, the one, the German, the...
Darendorf. No? Who were you?
No.
I'm not sure who you were thinking of.
I meant Ralph.
So Ralph Darendorf.
Who was German minister and then became professor and director, the teacher of Gatron Esch, and we were together also on television shows and everywhere. We were together once at a Bilderberg meeting, and the number two thing is that I was speaking here about 20 years ago, even more, in a similar room, and my host was a professor from London School of Economics, adjunct professor, George Schöpflin, who invited me. He also wrote very nice reviews of some of my books. And in 2010, he was elected to the Hungarian Parliament on the ticket of Fidesz. And since then, he has been at a meeting at the European Union where I presented the previous book on Hungary, which we then discussed the things there, and I congratulated him on becoming an MP, and he congratulated me on the book. I met all his wives. The last is or was an Estonian, somewhat younger, and he was a very able man and wrote very good books on the danger of nationalism, racism, extremism. And then he became an MP, and he's now a different man. Perhaps you know him much better than I do. So these are my contacts with this building and with the London School of Economics, and several people whom I admire very much, like Sir Karl Popper and so on, were connected with this building. I don't know whether Peter F. Drucker was teaching here, but anyhow. So I am very happy, and I am willing to try to answer any question. I would like to stress I am not member of any party, either in Hungary or in Austria. I have been an Austrian citizen since the 28th of September 1959, and don't belong to any fraternity except the Austrian Automobile Club.
Notorious.
I left the American Express because I was once in the States and I suddenly paid with American Express card, and it was a much bigger piled up debt on the card. I mean, I paid them all, but so I got a letter in when I came back from the local American Express office in Vienna so that I should consult them if I suddenly spent so much money. And then I got so upset. I was still younger and my temperament remained Hungarian, went through with me, and I wrote to them, I don't want to do anything with you, so I have only one card, a MasterCard, because this is my bank. Otherwise, I am a perfectly free agent, and yes, I had an English wife for many years, and I have a Hungarian wife, have an English connection or a British connection, because my stepdaughter is now for the past 4 years in Greenwich, working for the local government, not paid very well, with her partner, who is working for a Catholic girls' school, paid even worse, and also they have a baby, so I know everything about the nurseries too, and follow the events in the UK ever since she came here, much closer. She started out in Bristol with a scholarship. So I have absolutely no chains, real or others. Go ahead.
Okay. If
we haven't discussed anything, what we are going to discuss?
No, I mean, in that case, I wonder if you could take because people will have very varied knowledge, I think, about the roots of the regime, and I wonder if you could describe and explain to people the paradox of Orbán's beginnings in terms of where he has come to now in his politics. What was Orbán's sort of primary politics in the early 90s? What made him famous in Hungary, in fact?
Well, I was working also for the Austrian television as an East European commentator and editor-in-chief for Eastern Europe and Soviet Union and so on. And in 1989, July, there was a fantastic event in Hungary, a posthumous burial of the people who were killed after the 1956 revolution. You know, in Hungary, there was in 1956, 23rd of October, a revolution, an uprising, and the regime collapsed in 10 days. And afterwards, Hungary was the only country in the world where communism was resurrected. And a man took over, who was an older communist, who was serving Moscow, but at the same time, people forgot that he wasn't only communist, he was also a Hungarian. And he then managed to find loopholes so that after he killed all the people whom he betrayed, he took Hungary to the road of the so-called goulash communism, as Khrushchev said, the regime was more bearable than the other East European countries. You got the little freedoms, you could travel, everything. You got a foreign exchange allowance with the proviso that you don't attack the Soviet Union, the great friend of Hungary, or Hungarian communism. And they killed the prime minister of the revolution, who was an incredible story himself. A man coming from peasant stock, who lived in as an emigre, a communist activist in Moscow, came back in 1945. He was Minister of Interior, then Minister of Agriculture, then member of the Politburo. And in 1956, because 3 years earlier he became prime minister, he took me out of the jail and the concentration camp together with 15,000 other people in Hungary, 1953. And he, Imre Nagy, a real Hungarian name, he was then deposed by the Russians and by the agents of the Russians. And then, in 1956, the people wanted him to become the chairman, the president, the prime minister of a new government. And there were fantastic demonstrations, civil war, in the sense that the whole Hungarian nation rose up, but with the help of the Russian army, they suppressed the revolution. That's how many people left, 200,000 people left Hungary. And Imre Nagy was arrested, taken to Moscow, and then, 1958, July, he was, after a secret trial, killed together with 4 other people, including a journalist with whom I, as a very young journalist, started to work. And that was the time when 1989, after the communist systems all over Eastern Europe were cracking, and Hungary was leading the way in kind of reforms within the regime, a kind of forerunner, there was the posthumous funeral of Imre Nagy and these people on the Heroes Square. And you must imagine the relatives who didn't even know previously where these people were buried. They didn't have marked graves. You had to dig out and find them and identify after years and years. And it was a fantastic event, replete with also the contradiction of Hungarian history, because there were also the spokesmen of the party still, the who were reformers, but who served this regime. And there, 6 people talked, including a friend of mine who helped to get me out of jail, who was then on a television film, a fantastic man called Miklós Vásárhely. There was Béla Király, a general, who was leading the Hungarian army and then managed to escape and went to the United States, later became an MP in Hungary. And there one young man, 26 years old, spoke, whom no one knew. Beard, blue jeans, called Viktor Orbán, 6.5 minutes. He spoke and he said, we want a real government which starts negotiations about the evacuation of the Russian troops. This man founded a party, young people, 29 young people, students, founded a party which was called Fidesz, which is the equivalent of Young Hungarians. And this party, with the help also of a philanthrop from America called George Soros, who paid for the printing plants, everything, and also that they learned English, they became politicians. Most of them were law students. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of economic students. They set up this, and they participated at the first elections, 1990. This man who gave this speech was obviously the greatest talent, And this philanthrop, George Soros, who was a very rich man, born in Hungary, he gave him and later others a scholarship, paid a scholarship to Pembroke College in Oxford. I visited yesterday the college. Unfortunately, vigilance is so strong, I couldn't really walk around. I could in the university college where I gave a lecture last night to Austrian students and then international audience about Austria and Hungary in two languages, because students I spoke in German, both of them with Hungarian accent. But it's a language of luxury, suited only for love, poetry, and my younger stepson, who is here, and I'm very happy. Learned about the Hungarians and at school. They are proud and pastor.
So there's this really exceptional event where Orbán kind of bursts onto the scene, really, as this firebrand, as a young politician who seems incredibly... Because this is a period where there's been no consolidation of democracy, no sort of change of institutions. This is still a very risky time when he stands up and makes these very strong pronouncements. How would you define... As he emerges into the public light in the early 90s, how would you define his politics and that of Fidesz?
I met him when he was still left of the center liberal. Mm-hmm. He gave a talk, not very good English, at the Institute for the Human Sciences, EWM, in Vienna. I asked a difficult question. I forgot already the question, also his answer. But afterwards, the director, who was a Pole, Michalski, Professor Michalski, invited me and a couple of people at the dinner together with him. Mm-hmm. And he was very modest, intelligent, and honest. He said, yes, there is one man. I said, I heard about another man in Fidesz who is called Gábor Fodor. He said, yes, he is more, so to say, my rival, he said. And he was then vice president also of the Liberal International, mm-hmm. which had a meeting in Budapest. And he gave speeches in parliament. They all appeared like students, long-haired, bearded, jeans, and they was attacking the church, religion, nationalism. And he was left of the center. But there was a fight in the party. Mm-hmm. You know, Churchill said, there is no friendship in politics, particularly at the top, that you see now in the English Conservative Party, but also in the Labour Party. And
everywhere.
So what's happened was, he very young, he already showed his true colors. He came back from Pembroke. Mm-hmm. He had a 9-month scholarship to write about the civil society, the NGOs and the civil society and the pattern of Poland. Mm-hmm. 9 months, he brought out his wife and baby daughter, who recently completed the finishing school with 50,000 euro fee in Switzerland. She was born in that year, and they came also to Pembroke College. And then after 4 months, he came back to Hungary, Christmas, and he saw a totally new situation. He went back. He left the scholarship, everything, went back with his wife and became a professional politician and killed, quote unquote, the other rival, who was 15 centimeters taller, much better looking. The girls loved him and not Orbán, and Orbán was the soccer player. Mm-hmm. And the former editor of the Fidesz paper called Hungarian Orange, which still exists but now against Fidesz, became later Minister of Culture, a man called Bozóki, András Bozóki, said recently, I quote him, he has 3 interests in life: power, money, and soccer. There is no question about that. Anyhow, so he then got rid of this rival, and the rival and two other MPs went to the bigger liberal party. Mm-hmm. This bigger liberal party were mainly urban intellectuals, many who were sons of former communists, socialists, Jewish, etc. He was with the Fidesz, mainly people who came from very poor families from the countryside. Orban was so poor that at the age of 15, he himself said, an unforgettable experience in his life. For the first time, he could switch on the tap and have hot water. He worked in the fields. He was very, very poor family. His father was a Communist Party member, and not only that, but locally, he went to work in Libya, and so that was, generally speaking, the situation, his background, and the background of the other people. There are Hungarian scholars who say it's an incredible thing, never happened anywhere, that about 15 to 20 students got stuck together, and they are all now two together. There is only one exception, one is a special story, and all of them became very leading personalities, mm-hmm. the President of the Republic, the Prime Minister, the Chairman of Parliament, the Speaker of Parliament, the head of the faction in the European Parliament, the Chief Justice, who has the power to move cases and to dismiss all other judges, was also in the college together, her husband, too, who wrote the preamble of the Constitution. They all together, and there are some other people who became very rich, and this is the group which runs Hungary, but he is the number one.
I think it's one of the most interesting aspects in the book, is tracing the topography, if you like, of this group and the extent to which they have remained an incredibly...
The role of personality is very important.
And the extent to which they really have got a lock, essentially, on all the key institutions at this point, but how cohesive that particular group has been. A couple of questions that come to mind. Given one of the other themes of the book is how polarized Hungarian politics now is, the extent to which neither political side can talk about the other except as... Adam Michnik, the Polish dissident, had a phrase in the 1980s, which is angels and maggots, which was a tendency within communism as well, that your enemy, there's no ethical pluralism in this discussion, that your opponent is not just your opponent within reasonable grounds of a common set of rules. They are the enemy, they are evil, they are absolutely not to be accepted as anything other than a danger to the nation, that you have this degree of political polarization now in Hungary. And I wanted to ask how different, and whether it really was different, in the early years after the revolution, whether there was, if you like, a more ethical pluralism, the extent to which...
Revolution, you mean 56?
No, I mean by after 89. So in the first years of democracy, the extent to which... Because you talk about this terrible polarization now, which makes democratic discourse almost impossible because it's a kind of winner-takes-all style of politics. And the extent to which that was that so different in the 1990s?
Now
was there an acceptance between...
The 1990s was... A bit like Klondike, suddenly people became very, very rich. Like in the Czech Republic, too.
Sure.
Some people became very rich. And also, you see, most of the people were all involved who were over a certain age in the regime. Because in contrast to Poland, in Hungary, it was a peaceful, totally peaceful change 56, but it was 33 years afterwards under Kádár, and it was co-opted a very high degree section, large section of society. Mm-hmm. So there were about a couple of hundred real opposition who were mainly liberals. Fidesz didn't belong, they came later, mm-hmm. and some of them were in jail or kicked out or went out. And you see, that was a different thing. I was just lecturing the other day together with Agnes Heller, the philosopher, who was very critical of the regime, was a former communist, as most critics are everywhere, who criticized the dictatorship. And she was saying that Orban is a tyrant. And I said to her, Agi, you can't say that he's not like Putin. You are allowed to go back. She is now at my Asian lectures in Latin America. Last week she was in Austria, lives in Budapest. And these people were then criticizing, but they were not jailed. They were allowed to go out, and she became the successor of Hannah Arendt at the New York School of Social Research. So, and in the same way today, they are not jailed. Anyhow, so what I wanted to tell you is that it was a fantastic mixture of sudden richness and terribly grave disappointments. People became unemployed suddenly. Mm-hmm. Under communism, under a dictatorship, you are equal in the poverty, in the misery, except a few people at the top, but their style of living can't be compared to the present-day leader. And suddenly they found that unemployment, existence of unemployment, suddenly they lost jobs. Mm-hmm. The entire edifice of artificial factories collapsed, which gave a fantastic push to the problems with the Roma, gypsies, even those who had jobs lost it. Mm-hmm. So it's all combined. At the same time, they became quote-unquote free. But as Sadat said, you can't eat freedom.
But at the top of the political system, so if we took the Hungarian parliament in the first 5 years of the 1990s, so the debates between the Hungarian Democratic Forum and the Reform Communist Hungarian Socialist Party, how democratic is that discourse?
It was foreshadowing today.
In the sense of being very polarizing.
Yes, right. Some respects. What happened was suddenly there were several parties. Mm-hmm. The chairman of the MDF, the Conservative Party, was someone who was the director of the Museum for Medical Things, the Medical Museum, whose father was a former minister in the Horthy regime who saved thousands of Poles. He was one of the persons who was not only tolerated, but decorated by the Kádár regime. Mm-hmm. And there came the negotiations about the new constitution, and it turned out that this man, József Antal, puts all the others who were the founders and loud mouths in his pocket. He was brilliant. I've known him. I made a great interview with him. But he also, however, was faced with an extreme right-wing challenge, very right-wing, racist, anti-Semitic in his party itself. Mm-hmm. He had to make compromises, and then he didn't have any idea of the economy and the government, and lost then not only his touch, but his health. He had a cancer, and he died very, very soon. The socialists were led by someone who was a reform socialist, this reform communist, former foreign secretary, foreign minister. You know, the reform communist opened the so-called Iron Curtain and helped. The German unity wouldn't have been possible if the Hungarians in 1989 summer don't open the borders for the East Germans who were then in Hungary. Anyhow, and the right, the Social Democrats were there, the post-communists who were very weak. Then was a so-called smallholders, agrarians, and they all were involved in the regime somehow or others. They were not resistance fighters. And these young people, they were the men with a clean record. And they were so popular that they were thinking in 1994 that they will get 100 seats in parliament. And in the end, because of the split, they got only 24. and what's happened then in Hungary, that's the key, what's happened to what's happened later. The two parties, the liberals, the real liberals who were involving in his ranks were people who really were fighting the communist regime, concluded a pact with the post-communist socialists, the socialists who were coming from the Communist Party, and they won the elections. They won almost two-thirds of the seats because the people were so disappointed. I compare them as if you are in a prison and the prisoners are released together with the director of the jail. They found a new venture. That's happened in Hungary. And that finished the liberals because in the end they lost their credibility. The communists, the so-called social democrats, were then doing the things, building a capitalist economy and becoming corrupt. And then they lost their touch, and then came these young people, and within 4 years, Orbán got the relative majority, became the youngest prime minister, because since 1993 he discovered that the majority is only right of the center. He discovered the nation, that is the real issue. He discovered religion. He was himself originally, he himself said, atheistic. He married a Catholic, a devout Catholic young student. He was Protestant. They were not married in church. And later they married in church, and he discovered that too, and the religion, and he became a real conservative, national, right-wing political leader.
Because I think that's where what's so analytically interesting is if you have a figure like Orbán, but also like Klaus, arguably, and like the Kaczynski twins in Poland, who were the spin doctors for Lech Wałęsa in the early 90s and have been very politically entrepreneurial since. When you have these phenomenally entrepreneurial characters, the analytical question becomes, well, how is it that the political space that becomes the developmental space, if you like, politically, is so far on the nationalist right? How is it that becomes...
Because nationalism is the strongest ideology.
But then the question is why? Because in the early, one of the other affinities between Poland and Hungary is that if you look at the reform communists on the left, these are the two most Blairite social democratic countries in parties in Central Europe. They are the most economically liberal of all the reform communist parties. And I wonder if there's any, what you would make of the argument
they
that...
They forgot one thing.
Okay.
Which probably most of the left forgot,
yep.
The nation. The nation, you see, there was a famous Hungarian poet who, like all famous Hungarian poets, totally unknown abroad, Gyula Iyes, who said, what is the difference between patriots and nationalists? The patriot defends something. The nationalist wants something. And that is the difference, he said. And the entire national issue was buried. Why? Hungary was the great loser of the First World War. Trianon, 4th of June, 1920, the country lost 75% of the territory, 40% of the population. Every third Hungarian became a subject of countries of where which they previously regarded as nothing. Romania, Slovakia, Czechoslovakia, then Yugoslavia. And these people were treated a little bit like the minorities were treated in Hungary. Hungary, Austria, Austro-Hungarian monarchy, and the national issue became the key issue because my mother came from Siebenbürgen, Transylvania, which is now Romania. My father came from Kosovo, the famous writer Márai was born. And this, of course, means that it was an issue because so many people had relatives. During the were in the interval period, that was the main basis of the regime. After the under the communism, not a word was about it. And the post-communists also underestimated it. Orban said, nation, the first decree and law, 2010, was the National Day, remembering the 4th of June, and Hungarians abroad got, without any difficulty, the Hungarian citizenship. First they said only citizenship, even the then foreign minister said on my TV program in Vienna. Then a year or two later, they gave them the right to vote in a country where they never lived, never paid any social security or taxes, and their votes are not even really controlled. Anyhow, so this was the key issue which the socialists and the liberals underestimated. That's the national issue. That is also what Kaczynski does. The only difference is Kaczynski is anti-Russian. Orban has become, in the meantime, a very good personal friend of Vladimir Putin, Erdogan, and others.
But I think what strikes me both in Poland and in Hungary is that in Poland there was an agreement, and also to some extent in Hungary, to draw a so-called thick line under history, the idea that there would not be lustration policies, there would not be retributive actions against the communists. The idea was these were going to be flourishing democracies, they were the furthest ahead in those reforms. And what strikes me is that if these countries had had less socially polarizing economic experiences, if democracy had brought with it the kind of social flourishing and economic flourishing that they were expecting and in many respects promised in the early 90s, the nationalism card would not have been nearly so potent. I mean, do you think there's any, is it reasonable to suggest in any way that it has been the last refuge politically, given the divisiveness, that basically all parties agreed on various degrees of radical economic reform, left and right, the reformist left, the democratic right, agreed that the way forward was to join the European Union, to have very radical market reforms, to liberalize, democratize. It's very difficult to compete over that when it's such a consensual position, both in the countries and in the parties. But there's a great gamble in that,
and
which is that it will
that's
work.
That's all true in theory.
Right.
There was a great German, he still exists, a great German political scientist, Klaus Offer, who wrote a piece. He can point to it, in which he said in 1990 that it is an insoluble contradiction. By opening the gates to democracy, the people become free. But at the same time, without any experience in democracy, in civilized intercourse, and suddenly the free market comes in the place of a command economy, which was built on prices which were not real and wages, that the contradiction between the two, and that's what's happened. Even 10, 20 years later, in Hungary, the majority of people said, had a nostalgia towards the Kádár era, because there was a kind of seeming normality and equality, and this was getting better, and that the Hungarians were regarded everywhere. They were the man who had money, foreign exchange in their pocket. And now what's happened? Came the foreigners, bought up Hungary, and now they even lecture them what they should do. So all this is a very complex situation, which you, and the personalities play a great role. It is true. My wife is always angry when I say that about Orban. He is a brilliant politician, much more intelligent than Kaczynski, much more cynical
Mm-hmm.
They're much more normal.
With a much bigger majority as well.
Kaczynski invented that his brother was killed by the Russians in an accident. I mean, it's unbelievable. I've been recently in Poland, and we appeared with Adam Michnik together. It's unbelievable. I mean, all right, he's a latecomer, and he wants to do it all very quickly, but Orbán did much more cleverly. Orbán is a very clever, totally cynical operator who knows how to win friends and has a political sense. Incredible. And Locke. Mm-hmm. He was lucky with Trump. He was the only East European, only common market politician in the European Union who said he is for Trump. He was, of course, for Trump because Hillary Clinton and the Clintons were very critical of the developments in Hungary. But he said it, and he came up. But of course, he hoped that he will be the first who goes to Washington. And the great disappointment was the first East European who appeared in the White House was on top of it, the Romanian president, who on top of it, not a real Romanian, but an ethnic German from Transylvania, which shows that such things are possible in Romania.
I mean, I think what's remarkable about the nationalism is the extent to which it's allowing the Kaczynski in Poland, or rather Law and Justice in Poland and Orbán in Hungary, to argue that they're really revolutionaries in the sense that they have argued that the revolution of 1989 was not a real revolution because it allowed the continuation of these corrupt networks and these liberals pretending to be liberals who were really in some way connected to the old ways of doing things, the old compromises and so on, and that the true revolution of the nation begins now, begins with their regimes, and that is a fundamentally anti-democratic idea, the idea that you win the entire system to remake it in its entirety. And so that includes getting rid of the democratic constitutions of the 1990s, the checks and balances of the 1990s. I mean, but what once you've done that, the most dangerous time for revolutions in some ways is when you've won, right? I mean, once you've made that argument, how do you see the viability of the current regime, given its incredible tensions with the European Union? The paradoxes of its economy and so on.
Revolutionary. It always reminds me when I was for the first time in Mexico, and wherever one goes as an analytical or political writer, one doesn't just go to the sea and to the ocean, but goes around. And I was fascinated by the Party of Permanent Revolution, which was running Mexico. And in 6 years, you could do anything still. After 6 years, you are out. Mm-hmm. But this is different. They don't call themselves permanent revolutionary, but they can stay longer, like Orbán. You see, I mean, he's only 54, you see. So what I think is, your question was a very loaded question. We should start a new discussion about it. Orbán said, this is also one of the fantastic things, ladies and gentlemen, his most important political speeches he holds, not in Hungary, not in Budapest, but in the heart of Transylvania, which were ethnic Hungarian students and the Romanians alloyed. And he gave a speech in 2014 when he said that he is time to say that we are for the illiberal state and liberal democracy is out. The real success story, said a little bit hastily, is Turkey, Russia, Turkey, Russia, he said also Singapore, but he said Turkey, Russia, and there was one more country, wait a second, he said China. And he is also very friendly with Turkey. But he gave this speech then, which he showed him. He let his hair down, as one says here, so that people knew he had enough of liberal democracy. It should be an illiberal state. And this year, he said in the same place in Transylvania before the Hungarian students, he said, 8 years ago, we thought Europe is our future. Now we know we are Europe's future. God should save Europe, of course. That he didn't say, I edit here now at the London School of Economy. But this is the situation. And when you ask me, I can tell you he discovered one more issue, and he was the first to use it, the refugee. Mm-hmm. The refugees and the refugee policy and the migrant policy. And he is now, plays both sides. He is in the European Union as a prime minister, the oldest politician. Only Angela Merkel has been slightly longer. And he's much more intelligent than Kaczynski. He's very much against the sanctions. Mm-hmm. Against Russia, always comes out. He was very friendly with the French right. He's very friendly with the Austrian right. Mm-hmm. He has luck. He had Brexit. It has very complex consequences. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the position of those who are in the EU are stronger and more cohesion. He was lucky with Trump. He was lucky with the German elections. Merkel has become weaker. The Bavarians perhaps will get stronger. He gave a talk at the Bavarian Party Congress. And he, in Austria, too, the people who like him more, say, than some others, got stronger. So he has luck, and he knows how to use this luck, and he has no real opposition. I mean, the opposition in Hungary is weak, discredited, infighting, not worth talking about. Mm-hmm. There is some NGOs, social media, not such a civil society like in Poland, but still, and that might be the future. There is a young party, but they want to be alone, so there won't be any cooperation between the opposition parties. It's all ideal for the government. What do you want more?
If you think about the politics of Western Europe,
you asked me about the EU.
I'm interested in if you think of the polarization of West European politics after austerity, after the global financial crisis. One way of thinking about Central Europe is it's a region that has been under permanent austerity for 25 years, and you have the political polarization that comes with that, and also the difficulty of finding alternative forms of politics. For the social democratic left in Central Europe, it's incredibly difficult to know how they would proceed within the prevailing economic orthodoxy, how it would be possible to raise revenue in order to spend. So the real putative social democratic left is in an incredibly difficult position in emerging markets in Central Europe, it seems to me, given the financial and economic pressures they're under. For the moderate right, they've very much been eclipsed by these more nationalistic right-wing parties. Do you get a sense whether, let me put this more simply, are Kaczynski and Orbán, Law and Justice, Fidesz, are they the exceptions in Central Europe? Or do you feel they are the beginning of a wider strategy? Where do you think Anton Babiš is going in
that
the Czech Republic, for example?
That is the real question. Yeah. Babiš is something different. I met him twice. He is an entrepreneur who built up an empire, comes from the former communist elite. His father was also in the external trade, and he realized he can do politics, and he started this party, and he has a lot of money, and the first thing is one buys up papers, newspapers. That's what they all do, you know.
The Czech party is called Yes. which is a fantastic name for a political party, I think.
And then, but Babiš is different.
Yep.
But we shall see what he does when he will be prime minister. But you see, it is after all incredible in Romania that an ethnic German becomes president, that Karel Schwarzenberg, an Austrian aristocrat, whom everybody thought he's a kind of vis figure, a brilliant man, who lived 40 years in Austria and went back as an adult to his native country where they had big properties. He almost became president, you see, almost 44% ago. Anyhow, I think there is more variety in Eastern Europe, even in Slovakia. There is the social democratic leader, Fico, who is as much a social democrat like Orban, a decent conservative. They are both power politicians, but not a patch on Orban's ability is concerned. He is now moving closer to the European Union because he has problems. His Minister of Interior should have been already, I don't want to express myself brutally, no longer in the ministry but somewhere else, but he's still Minister of Interior. So there is corruption not only in Hungary. And Poland, you see, is different. Poland has always been different with the history. They started also in 56. They started in 81. And they had a fantastic economic success, but through their own bungling, it is not the social democracy, it's not God's punishment, it is the failure of the party leadership. The European Union cannot replace the domestic elites. It's impossible. And even worse, when the Americans, now a country where a Donald Trump who every week or every day produces the stupidities and the incredible things. They always find something. I can't read a piece of news about him which doesn't upset me. This man is the president of the biggest and most powerful country in the world, and there is a party supports him with the rifle, money, everything. And the New York Times, yesterday, in a leader, said to the new Austrian leader who will be the chancellor, the 31-year-old Sebastian Kurz, he shouldn't get into his government the freedomized because they are right-wing racists, etc. Number one, how comes the New York Times to dictate to the Austrians who should be in the government? B, coming from a country of Donald Trump, they have other problems, no? And of course they are right, but this is the answer. You know what people say. I don't say. I'm very happy that the New York Times says that because it makes the people a little bit at the top. Perhaps they think about it.
No, but it's somewhat disabling of American diplomacy, I think.
There are no ambassadors and nothing.
You know? I could happily monopolize asking you questions, but I'd like to open it up to anyone who... So I will go around bit by bit, sir, if you'd like to ask a question. Do we have any microphones, actually? Yes, we do. If you'd like to wait for the microphone and then...
Probably everyone will hear me,
right? But for the podcast, because we're recording this, it would be nice if they could hear you on the podcast as well. Thank you.
Do you think...
If you could introduce yourself, that would be nice.
I'm Ushuk Bora from Turkey. I'm an exchange student at LSE. And I was going to ask you whether you think that the Visegrad group is going to stay as a coherent whole, in your opinion, or are the attempts of the current French president, as well as many Western politicians, about undermining the Visegrad group's coherence, going to succeed? Do they really have common interests that are going to put them in the same side for long enough?
Very good question. I have a column in the Liberal Austrian Daily called The Standard. I've written on Tuesday about this with the title Luftschloss Visegrad. Luftschloss is a fairy tale castle something like that, Visegrad. Every young Hungarian pupil in the grammar schools was taken once at least in his life, many several times, to Visegrad. It goes back to the 14th century. It was the Hungarian king, who was an Anjou king, didn't really speak Hungarian. He built there a fantastic burg, a castle, and a big fortress. And then in the 14th and 15th century, the greatest Hungarian king, Matthias, and in 1335, October, the Anjou king, Robert Károly, invited the then emperor of Moravia, of Poland, two princes, reigning princes from Saxony and Bavaria, to a meeting. In those days, there weren't such communiques which we see now from the common market, EU meetings in Brussels, but this was something, and in 1990, one of the politicians discovered that the cooperation between Hungary, between Czechoslovakia still existed, Poland, and these were the three countries. They met in Visegrad and signed a free trade agreement. And this was the beginning. This became then four countries that they are the became today the Visegrad Group. Most people and my colleagues in the newspapers have not the foggiest idea what is Visegrad, but some of them even put an accent, but they don't know. So it goes back to a fairy tale in the 14th century, and in fact, this whole thing slept. It was a deep sleep until the refugee crisis. And then all these leaders of Slovakia, Poland, Kaczynski, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic discovered Orbán is right. Why should we take refugees? We have no foreign labor, we have no Muslims, we have no Arab or Turkish migrants. Why should we risk it? Yes, he is right. And so what's happened, this is the four countries which refuse the solidarity or the, if you wish, the values of the central of the European Union, but they all accept at the same time very gently and nicely, majestically, the money which they get from the taxpayers. My money, German money, Austrian, French, Belgians, Italians, 3 to 5% of the GDP is financed. So what I want to say that this Visegrad Group is a myth. There is no Visegrad Group. They are basically four different countries. In Slovakia, there are 500,000 Hungarians, which is a latent problem for the Hungarians and for the Slovaks. The Poles have a different relationship to Russia than the Hungarians. The Czechs had almost an Austrian nobleman as their president. They have now a slightly alcoholic top president who has very good French wine. I had it with him not so long ago, 2 hours, and he comforted me that he speaks very good English. And he will be probably the new president. And the previous president is making propaganda for Putin and for the extreme right wing in Austria and elsewhere. Anyhow, and this is the Czech democracy. So every country is different, and I don't think that there is a kind of institutional framework. The point is that they can only lose if they really try to bank on Macron or Merkel, because their policy is different. So I don't think they really mean a serious challenge, because the economy is in a very, very perilous shape.
Thank you. There was another. Yeah. Microphone's on its way.
Who was it?
That's the person with the LSE.
Good evening, Mr. Lendvai, and thank you for your lecture. I am Federico, and I'm a master's student here at the European Institute. So two things came up a lot during the conversation. One is nation and the role of the concept of nation in the history of Hungarian politics. The other one is Transylvania. So my question is, given the extreme stance on this issue of right-wing, far-right-wing movements, and also given the huge Hungarian minority living in Transylvania, is there really a case for a great Hungary in the government's policies and or at least in the government state propaganda?
I can tell you Romania was the third country which published my book on Orbán's Hungary. The English title is Europe's New Strongman. First it was published in German, then it was published in Hungarian, and a couple of weeks ago it was published in Romanian. As I don't speak Romanian, although I meet many Romanians in the hotels and elsewhere where I am staying, it seems to be that everything is in Romanian hands, very good hands. I can only tell you that it is a problem, it is a time bomb, minorities. As you see Spain, who would have thought what will happen? Catalans. So it is so that actually the relationship, there was a kind of up and down between the Hungarian minority and the Romanians. The Hungarians of Transylvania are different from the Hungarians in Hungary, because after all, it has been now many, many years that they lived in a different situation. They are very good writers. Some of the figures in Hungarian politics, opposition figures, come from Romania. And I think the great problem is that you can always mobilize the minorities and the majority, you see. The majority has to have an understanding for the minority, and this is very difficult in view of the events in Romania, where a part of Transylvania was taken over by Hungary during the Second World War. For the Hungarians, it was the homecoming. For the Romanians, the lot. People don't know. And the problem is when a neighboring country somehow incites the minority. And that was a problem until very recently, that the Hungarian right wing fueled the minority in Romania. And there was in Romania too, in various places, politicians who were playing the national card. Mm-hmm. It's always good. And in Romania are also people who were singing the praise of Ceausescu and are now there. Both countries have in German you see unbewältigte, unmastered part, the Romanians and the Hungarians. There are great jokes were in the Second World War in the BBC that both of them were fighting together, Hungarians and Romanians, on the side of Hitler. But the Romanians at the right time changed sides. The Hungarians always lost it. In the First World War, the Italians, and the Second, the Romanians. So they got back everything, you know? And so I think it is a potential danger. Depends very much on the government in Budapest and on the government in Bucharest. There is one common feature, unfortunately, and that's the corruption. Not only the ethnic Romanian ministers are kicked out or jailed, but also the ministers of the Hungarian minority. So the great thing is that Hungarians can become ministers, even minister of culture in the Romanian government. It's fantastic. But at the same time, it is so that they didn't really haven't given the rise to the Hungarians. You don't feel at home. It's very, very difficult. And therefore, it is a very high degree of responsibility for the Romanian government and the Hungarian government. For the moment, I would say there is this kind of parallel thing. The Social Democrats, now in power in Romania, are one of the most corrupt group which one can see in Central Europe, and their leader attacks the philanthropist George Soros in the same way as the Hungarian. So they are common in that one of them calls himself Social Democrat, the other is a conservative Christian national figure. So it is very, very interesting how it will go on, the situation, the momentan. I think personally that it is a kind of interval which can be deceptive, but it was much worse, the situation before. Depends much on the economic situation and the relationship. Both are in the European Union, so that is something which is, of course, a very important, I wouldn't say it blocks this, but it is nevertheless has an influence on the relation.
You mentioned George Soros several times through the talk. Could you explain what the significance of George Soros is currently? Because we're working into a Hungarian electoral campaign.
Could you briefly
explain why he's a very, very important
personal
figure at this point?
I shall be very personal. I am Hungarian. I am Jewish. I was a refugee. I went to Austria, remained there, had an English wife, become a British correspondent for many years. George Soros went 8 years earlier, and there are two things I can't change. One is that he's 1 year younger. The other is that he's $25 billion. What I could add is that I think, I made an interview in English with him for the Austrian television 30 years ago, 25 years ago, that I think my English is slightly better or less worse than his. But apart from that, I am perhaps one of the very few Hungarians who have never asked any favors or money from him. I only wrote him a letter, why doesn't he support the Hungarian liberal media? He didn't reply, but one of his people that they support, etc. I met him several times at conferences and so on, met some of his wives. But basically, I think he is a historic, tragic figure of Central Europe. There is someone who was a pupil of Sir Karl Popper, mm-hmm. and who wants to become also a kind of philosopher. And his greatest thing in life, not that he made so much money, he doesn't buy soccer teams or starlets or does things which spending the money. He spent his money until yesterday, $12 billion, for supporting an open society in every country in Central and Eastern Europe, in Russia, in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia, Macedonia, Albania, Kosovo, everywhere, also in the United States, and didn't interfere. This is and there is a university since the 90s in Budapest, the Central European University, 1,200 students yearly, an international academic staff. Since last October, a man who lectured here too, Michael Ignatev, a Canadian of Russian ancestors who wrote fantastic books about nationalism, also about his experiment as a politician in Canada after 3 years, has the additional advantage or disadvantage of a Hungarian wife. So he is fantastic. He is now director of the university, which is very good for the university. They want to eliminate it. Now there is great jubilation that they postponed the decision until January 2019, the end of 2018, which is, of course, a typical, very clever move by the regime, because, in fact, instead of agreeing to the compromise that the university will have a campus in Barnes, in America, they said the decision will be taken after the elections in 2018, April. So I wouldn't bet that the university in this form will exist. I don't know. I shall see the rector perhaps sometime later this year, but I can only say that this is a organized insecurity which is there, because people, academic staff or students, want to know where they will be in 2 or 3 years' time. Very difficult for them. And Soros gave now, because yesterday came the news, today in the papers, $18 billion to the Open Society Foundation. Mm-hmm. This foundation supported not only NGOs, political groups, liberal groups, also education, also medicine, medical science.
But could you explain the role he's playing in the Fidesz election campaign?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Because it's very particular.
Yeah, there is a fantastic contradiction. Fidesz, Orban, all of these people whom I mentioned together, most of them were the beneficiaries of this Open Society Fund. They were all got scholarships. The spokesman of the Hungarian government speaks excellent English due to George Soros. He studied in this country and studied in the United States altogether 3 years. Everything, and he goes this propaganda that Soros wrote 2 articles in the New York Review of Books, one of the best papers in the world, where he wrote that he is willing to help the refugees, and he first said 1 million, later said 300,000 should come to Europe to be distributed, and in Hungary the case was now 1,292 refugees. They didn't accept. Austria took 90,000, more per head than Germany. And Soros' article was taken as a pretext that he is actually wants to inundate, to flood Hungary and all the countries with refugees, you know, absolute nonsense. And he is not an institution. And they said that the European Union's policy is dictated by George Soros. The Hungarian commissioner in the commission in Brussels said he has no documents and information about any such things. Imagine what will be his fate if he goes back to Hungary. I think he will ask somewhere on the Riviera with his pension, because commissioners have a very good pension. Will be able to live, but he doesn't support the governments. And now they made a national consultation with 15 million euro expenses, sending out questionnaires and posters. Soros shouldn't laugh as last. The enemy is yet now not Russia, not the Soviet system, not world Jewry, but George Soros. He is the epitome, the symbol. And that's why I say it's tragic. And everybody in Romania, in Serbia, every Poland, they all attack him, mm-hmm. who has only given the people. I mean, there someone wrote an article, the daughter of a man who was in jail, who helped me to get out of jail, Miklós Vásárhely, and his daughter wrote, what this foundation has done in Hungary, that people could, lives could be saved, that modern machines were all installed first with the money of this foundation. And this was not only in Hungary. So at the same time, he was, of course, a brilliant speculator. I don't know. I never speculated in stock exchange. He has a feeling for this.
But to be blunt, to what extent do you think this is simply code for an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory?
I don't think, you see, the position is this. Not once was mentioned that George Soros is Jewish, only that you are Jewish can't be an excuse that you are not criticized. Mm-hmm. But everybody knows. In Austria, the Social Democrats lost partly because they engaged a very able communicator advisor from Israel. Mm-hmm. Another from Jewish communicator advisor from America, Mr. Finkelstein, is the chief advisor of Orban. He himself said he admires, he died recently. Mm-hmm. He helped him. And this other chap was very good doesn't speak German, but was very good finding how the polls, how the results have to be interpreted. And it turned out that together with a very rich man, they were involved in a corruption affair. He was arrested for one day, and it was shown. And then his name is Zilberstein. You don't have to say that he is Jewish, they don't. They know that he doesn't come from Ankara. So it is quite clear. And so there are these codes that here is someone, a survivor of the Holocaust, goes to England and then in America, an American, rich, with a beautiful wife, a private plane. It is incredible. I mean, I met a very rich man in Vienna, and my wife, the Hungarian publisher, very so personally said after a theater evening, first night, his daughter was acting in theater, "Won't you be late for your plane?" Because he wanted to go to London. And he answered, "No, my dear, it is my plane. I can't be late for it." And you see, it is the same thing with Soros, his own plane. But personally, it is a tragic situation. You know, it is incredible. I mean, I was so happy that in Monday there was a positive review of my book in the Financial Times, because 50 years ago, I started to work for the Financial Times with a monthly retainer of £4 in Vienna. And I was so incredibly happy when I got my visiting cards. They didn't pay much, but the most beautiful visiting cards. Red, engraved, black, unbelievable. That's also the very clever way of British quality papers to keep these walls.
We give you fantastic cards, but not necessarily payment. So, if you'd like to. Actually, we have very little time left, so if I take a few questions and you can...
Hello, my name is John. I'm a visitor to LSE tonight. I was just thinking whether... I was just thinking whether Orban or Kaczynski are unstoppable in terms of do we need to wait actually for them to do enough damage to their nation?
Do enough damage.
Does Orban or Kaczynski are unstoppable in Poland and Hungary that we need to wait until they do enough damage to their nations, such as Nigel Farage or Erdogan in Turkey, such that they become actually unpopular eventually and get out as they got elected?
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, very quickly. Yeah, we'll just gather up a few final ones and then Paul can choose. Yeah.
Hello there. I'm Chris. I'm also an outsider, part of the new party you talked about. And my question is around economic literacy and how that led to these anti-democratic tides in both Russia and in Hungary. So I think it would be enlightening if you could, let's say, interpret the similarities between Gorbachev's and Kadar's vision of democracy or light communism, and how both failed with regards to Putin's anti-democratic tendencies, and then later on we see Orban as his good little pupil.
Thank you. One last question. Sorry, we're going to close in time. But Professor Lenvai is actually going to sign books afterwards, so there's an opportunity.
A very good evening. My name is Armin. I'm from the UCL. And what I would like to ask is that you...
UCL, the University College London.
I see.
Is that you said that Orban had luck in Europe and elsewhere, that he had luck with the elections in Austria, that he had luck with the elections in Germany and in Poland. What I would like to ask is that in all of these elections, nationalism has played a great role. They were all nationalistic parties, speaking about very right-winged things. Now, Orban uses the same thing, and I would like to ask if this is the future, nationalistic, as you said, is the biggest or the strongest ideology, or there might be a change in this in the near future. It might be that, like a new identity, like the identity of being a European, swaps with the identity of being Hungarian or Austrian or German.
Thank you.
Very, very important questions. I have the weakness of answering giving long answers to short questions, but these are all, of course, complicated issues. I can only say that it is unbelievable the changes in human beings when you are in power. Power, I think Kissinger said, is an aphrodisiac. When you are in power, you lose your sense of proportions. You think everything is possible. And when you ask me about Putin and Erdogan or Gorbachev and Kada and nationalism and Austria, I can only tell you that is partly why I wrote this book. You know, Carlyle said, great men make history. It is not completely true. But someone who was also lecturing in this house, Sir Isaac Berlin, said the role of personalities, that the history is not a motorway, that there are no deviations. And perhaps 1%, but he says, what would it have become if there hadn't been a Lenin or a Stalin or a Hitler or a Gorbachev? And now you see this even in Hungary, and you saw in Russia. Gorbachev also a tragic figure in some ways. He got 1% at the last presidential elections. And if you read the books and everything, he didn't realize that the reforms mean the end of this regime. And he was that decent, also personally with his wife. I met him twice. And he represented something, and then came, of course, the entire chaos with Yeltsin, you see. It's incredible. And what's happened with the human being? There is Boris Nemtsov, who knows him today, was a brilliant governor. At the age of 29, became deputy prime minister. I had the honor of in Salzburg at a round table at a conference of the Swiss World Economic Forum being his host. An incredibly intelligent, attractive man, was one of the top leaders of the opposition, as you know, was shot in the vicinity of the Kremlin wall, which doesn't happen in Hungary. People are free to travel and people are not shot. But that shows what can happen and how someone whom everyone underestimated, like Stalin was underestimated. Of course, Trotsky was a much more intelligent and attractive personality. And the same way was who thought of Putin. That's why he became first prime minister, first head of the secret service, then prime minister, and then president. And so I think this is also history, perhaps, how the changes go and how certain people make it. There's a very interesting biography of Mussolini by a German historian, which was published last year. It's incredible. I didn't know that how left of the center originally Mussolini was, and how he became, and he was also a very clever operator, and then lost. So it is, of course, different. If you live in the same age and you are directly or indirectly affected, or if you read about it in history, you see. The great German philosopher Hegel said once that in history, the periods of happiness are the unwritten pages, which you don't read. And this is, you hear about Bangladesh only when there are floods. I don't think that people can breathe, that only in the Austrian and German television, the bad news, if you wish. Now you can ask whether there is hope and chance. It depends. I was very surprised, I must say, that, for instance, in France, Emmanuel Macron won the elections. I had the honor of leading my television discussion program in Austria last Sunday. I mean, we taped it exceptionally on Saturday because Sunday were the elections. And I had there German correspondents and the former Le Monde correspondent, the French woman and an Austrian former diplomat. And it is fantastic that there comes a brilliant young man, 39, starts a movement. Of course, that's history. The opinion polls, you know, it's like, of course, if you start doing the reforms, the tough things which affect the people's pocket, but long run, help. You have to pay the price.